Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. There's a slight chance of rain and thunderstorm today and tonight, with comfortable temperatures in the low 80s during the day and the high 50s at night. Tuesday should be mostly sunny with a high near 84, but after that there's a slight chance of rain and thunderstorms during days and nights throughout the week, all the way through Saturday. Good news, and we'll see if it really happens. I think you'll hear in a minute from Dennis Hart that we're officially in a severe drought, so let's hope that we do get some rain. Dennis?
The coronavirus continued to dominate news around Iowa this past week, as it has for so many weeks and so many months now. The death toll from the virus exceeded 925 in Iowa yesterday. The number of infections surpassed the 48,000 mark. Iowa State University announced that of the 3,000 students who had returned to campus by Thursday of last week, 66 of them, or about 2.2%, had tested positive for the virus. Tests were done for students moving into residence halls or campus apartments. More test results will be announced this Friday. Meanwhile, the University of Iowa announced it will not require all students to be tested for the virus before they move into residence halls for the upcoming fall semester. The university said one-time testing only provides data for a specific point in time and can miss cases in the early stages of infection, giving students a false sense of security. Students will be provided with and mandated to wear cloth face coverings. More than 300 U of I instructors have rejected the school's planned hybrid approach of online and in-person instruction for the fall semester. They pledged last week to hold their classes only online. And the university's graduate and professional student government bodies urged the university to offer only online instruction last week. And the University of Iowa also announced that if the Hawkeye football team gets to play this fall, only about 10,000 to 15,000 fans will be allowed inside Kinnick Stadium for the games, and they will all need to wear face coverings. Meanwhile, there was word that someone at the Irving Elementary School in the Indianola School District had tested positive for the coronavirus last week, 4 days after the school had reopened last Tuesday. This after Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds had pushed back at school districts that were threatening to ignore a state mandate on in-person learning. She said those districts would be defying not her, but state law. She said if the districts moved primarily to remote learning without approval, those days would not count toward instructional time, and students would not receive credits for those classes. She also said school administrators who defy the state's rules could face discipline. Earlier, the Urbandale School Board had unanimously voted to continue online-only learning at the Rolling Green Elementary School. The board took its stand only hours after the district superintendent had sent a letter to parents saying the State Department of Education had turned down the district's request to extend online-only learning at the year-round school. And the school board in Waukee also said it would not follow the governor's guidance on reopening schools, asserting that state law gives school districts the power to make their own decisions about how to handle potential hazards to their students and staff. Meanwhile, school districts in both Ames and Iowa City decided last week that students would not return to school, either online or in person, until September 8th. Iowa City school officials said a delayed start will give them time to see how the influx of students attending the University of Iowa would impact infection rates in Johnson County. In Des Moines, word that area Catholic schools would reopen this month with in-person classes 5 days a week, as well as a fully remote learning option for students who choose it. In Windsor Heights last week, the city council passed a resolution asking residents to wear face coverings in public places. Later in the week, the Johnson County Board of Supervisors also passed a face covering regulation, as did the city of Dubuque. And the Story County Board of Health had finalized and approved a request to the Board of Supervisors to adopt a universal face covering ordinance. In Des Moines, numerous Iowa religious leaders called on Governor Reynolds to issue a public mask mandate. At least 33 other states have some kind of statewide mask order. The religious leaders asked the governor to require anyone to wear a mask inside any public building when they cannot social distance. Earlier, the Iowa Medical Society and 14 other health professional groups had written a letter to the governor urging her to issue a mask requirement. Meanwhile, another one of the casualties of the coronavirus outbreak was announced last week. It's this week's scheduled Major League Baseball game at Dyersville's Field of Dreams between the Chicago White Sox and the St. Louis Cardinals. That game was postponed to sometime next season. Also last week, word that the University of Northern Iowa would not play football this fall. That word came after the Missouri Valley Football Conference announced it had pulled the plug on its fall football schedule, moving those games to spring. And Drake University also announced it will not play football this fall. Its conference, the Pioneer Football League, said it was canceling the fall season and would not say if it planned any games next spring. But Drake University announced that it will host the first ever Black Oval Showcase on August 29th, a professional track and field meet that will feature 100 elite athletes from around the world, as long as they are now training in the U.S. The campus will follow coronavirus safety guidelines. No members of the public will be allowed to attend. Meanwhile, the Big 12 Conference, which includes Iowa State, announced it will only let its member schools play one non-conference game this fall, in addition to the 9 conference games already scheduled. Iowa State had 3 non-conference games on its schedule, all at home. And with all this going on, there was word last week that the state of Iowa's epidemiologist, the person helping lead the state's response to the coronavirus pandemic, had received a big pay hike. Caitlin Padotti's salary was raised 45% to $265,000. That brings her salary to the level of her predecessor. Padotti has advised Governor Reynolds during the pandemic while the governor was making decisions about allowing businesses to reopen and about requiring schools to hold in-person classes. In other news last week, Governor Reynolds signed an executive order restoring the voting rights of thousands of Iowans who have felony convictions and who have served their sentences. Iowa was the last state in the nation that still banned all people with felony convictions from voting, even after they had completed their sentences, unless they applied individually to the governor's office to have their rights restored. The governor had spent the past 2 years advocating for the state legislature to pass a constitutional amendment that would restore voting rights. Also last week, the Des Moines City Council unanimously approved a police request to buy $99,000 in ammunition to be used both on duty and for training. 396,000 rounds of various calibers for both handguns and rifles will be purchased from an Indiana company. In other news last week, word that a contractor for the Iowa State University Foundation was the victim of an international ransomware attack that might have included people's donation amounts, dates of birth, and phone numbers. The New York-based company paid a ransom and confirmed the information was destroyed and would not be used. The Iowa State Foundation said it does not store Social Security numbers, bank account information, or credit and debit card data. On the political front, word that Vice President Mike Pence will come back to Iowa this coming Thursday for a series of events in Des Moines. It will be the Vice President's 11th visit to Iowa and his 4th this year. When he's in Des Moines, he will make a speech, then attend a town hall event and a private dinner. Meanwhile, the Des Moines Register reported that 7 of Iowa's 10 major party nominees who are seeking federal office are women. Nationally, 584 women filed to run in races for the U.S. House of Representatives this year. That surpasses 2018's total of 476. Another 60 women filed to run for the U.S. Senate, topping the previous record of 53, which was also set in 2018. On the crime beat, a woman was shot and killed in Fort Dodge last week. She was identified as 38-year-old Maggie Herdell. Authorities arrested her estranged husband, 43-year-old Justin Herdell, in connection with the killing. Also last week, 66-year-old Jerry Lynn Burns of Manchester was sentenced to life in prison without parole for the 1979 murder of 18-year-old Michelle Martinko. The Cedar Rapids teenager was found stabbed to death in her parents' car at a Cedar Rapids mall. Burns was arrested in 2018. In another story, the family of a University of Iowa student who died during last year's polar vortex weather event filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the university last week. 18-year-old Gerald Michael Belts was found frozen to death near the residence hall where he lived on campus. The so-called polar vortex brought the wind chill to 50 degrees below zero in parts of Iowa. Also last week, the U.S. Agriculture Department had some unsettling news. It said that part or all of 13 Iowa counties were now in an extreme drought. They are Adair, Audubon, Boone, Calhoun, Carroll, Cass, Crawford, Dallas, Greene, Guthrie, Sac, Shelby, and Webster counties. In addition, part or all of another 21 counties are in severe drought. They include Story, Hamilton, and Polk counties. And the director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub said last week that Iowa's weather was the worst of the Midwest among corn-growing states. Meanwhile, the Des Moines Water Works got permission from the state of Iowa last week to start drawing water from the Raccoon River. That moved the utility one step closer to building a water treatment plant that would serve West Des Moines, Waukee, and Van Meter. And one more note from last week, word that Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller had filed a lawsuit against a state resident who allegedly price gouged during the coronavirus pandemic. Brenda K. Noteboom of Orange City is accused of selling more than 300 items over eBay at excessive prices, Among other things, she's accused of selling a 34-ounce bottle of hand sanitizer for $37.99, a 4-pack of toilet paper for $44, and a 6-pack of paper towels for $45. Earlier this year, her brother had also been charged with price gouging. And that is your summary of the week's news from all around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, taking off now, but planning to be right back here in this virtual seat on Friday, when I'll have word on what's been making news around Ames. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay right here, because there's more to come, much more, on Local Talk.
Summer, written and performed by the Japanese composer Joe Hisaishi. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thank you for the news, Dennis Hart. This week has been designated a week of action, organized by a coalition of Iowa groups joining forces to raise awareness about safety and how schools are being reopened, as mandated by the governor. Participating groups in the coalition called Iowans for a Safer Return to Learning include the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, Drives for Lives, Iowa Educators for a Safe Return to Learning, Iowa Citizen Action Network, Iowa State Education Association, Des Moines Education Association, Iowans for Public Education, Iowa Cities for Community Improvement, and Western Iowa Labor Federation. We have the founders of two of these organizations with us today. Jeremy Drumkrieger is joining us from Sioux City and has been a teacher in Northwest Iowa during the past 7 years, and he co-founded Iowa Educators for a Safe Return to School. Also, Daniel Gutman represents Drives for Lies. He is in Urbandale and teaches for Des Moines Public Schools. First, a little bit about your organizations. Jeremy, you're the co-founder of Iowa Educators for a Safe Return to School. Explain what has happened.
We began about a month ago. We now have about over 21,000 people who have signed up on our group. We decided that after Governor Reynolds came out with her plan to basically not really have a plan, we decided to make this group just to talk amongst ourselves, and it kind of went a lot bigger than we expected it to be. And now we have like thousands of people, and we're constantly talking and trying to figure this out. And if you look at the page, there's a lot of confusion and fear. It's not going away.
When you say the page, you're saying that most of this has happened over social media?
Mm-hmm. It's a Facebook group, and people are interacting constantly.
Who are these parents and teachers that are joining this Facebook page?
People from all over Iowa, teachers, parents, there's grandparents on there that are concerned about their kids. We have grandparents on there that are concerned about their kids who are teachers. It's just a lot of people just trying to figure out what's going on.
You became somewhat known, too, because you published your own obituary describing a lonely and isolated death from complications of COVID-19, and you encouraged other teachers to do the same and send them to the governor. Tell us just a little bit about that.
I wrote my own obituary, and it picked up over in the national news. Essentially, what I wanted to do was get everyone's attention about the fact that eventually, if this opens up the way that she wants it to, Governor Reynolds, that eventually teachers will probably die, some of them. And I know that there are some teachers out there who have retired because of this. There is one in Sioux City who had a husband who has tons of ailments, and she's just so fearful that she would take it home to him that she retired early. So it was important for me to get that out there. Just let people know that this is it's an actual concern. This isn't just some fake thing that we're worried about. It's going to affect teachers who are of age, my age and above, especially. So it's very concerning, and I hope I don't have to use that obituary.
Certainly. The fact that you did it really struck a chord with people. It kind of landed. Did you send it to the governor? Was there any response?
Yeah, I pitched it to the Iowa Starting Line, and they ran with it. But the governor, didn't respond. And I have not heard of anyone getting a response from her either.
Have other teachers been sending their obits?
They have, and they've actually been doing it across the country to their governors as well.
Oh, wow. So you set off like a national way of communicating about this for teachers.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let me check in with Daniel as well. Daniel, you co-founded Drives for Lives, which was, as I understand, it was a car procession in Des Moines in July with educators and other people making several demands. Can you describe a little bit what happened in July?
First off, as a special education teacher, I'm not a huge fan of the word demands. We have goals. Drive for Lives really, the genesis was a conversation that I was having with a close friend and colleague who teaches for another school district the week that district returned alarm plans were initially released. I was feeling pretty good about Des Moines Public Schools and the measures that they were putting into place. My friend was looking at going back to teaching at a school district that had no public health measures in place. And she was very concerned. She was distraught. She has three children of her own. She has contact with higher risk family members that she was worried about passing coronavirus on to, were she to be exposed. And we decided we needed to voice our concerns and figured maybe a few of us could drive around Terrace Hill or the Capitol and express our disagreement with Governor Reynolds. When July 17th came around with her proclamation that really stripped some of that local control and threw school districts for a loop, having to replan, our little event turned into over 1,000 people came down to Des Moines from across the state. We had a permitted legal car procession advocating for a safer return. It was really a beautiful event. It allowed teachers to find solidarity, provided a little bit of comfort. We're hoping that our voice helps turn into some action at the state level for a safer return.
Did you feel the procession was noticed by the governor's office, or was there any response to that?
There was no response from the governor. Again, like Jeremy said, I wasn't surprised by that. It was picked up to a certain degree by local media. But again, really, teachers are scared right now. And the action was to affect change, but there's also strength and comfort in that solidarity that we found. And teachers really need to find strength with each other and our allies right now.
So one of the goals that you have for this procession was to really return control to the local school boards?
Specifically in terms of planning for the return to learn, you know, I think there's a vital role for state government to provide guidance to school districts generally. Given that there's been a complete lack of leadership at the state government in addressing the coronavirus and issues arising from returning to learn, and that certain school districts such as Des Moines Public really stepped up and took the advice of public health experts, we feel that the state ceded that control to a certain degree. And those districts that are making responsible choices need to be able to move forward and do that.
Now, in Story County, where we are, the school board was working very closely with the public health department in the county. Was that happening in both of your districts as well?
Yes, for Des Moines, absolutely.
And what about in Sioux City, Jeremy?
Yes, of course they are, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying that the school districts are working really hard, but they're sort of, you know, between a rock and a hard place. You know, they just, if one school district does everything just perfectly, it almost doesn't even matter because then the one next door is able to just throw everything out the window and just not worry about it. And it's just going to affect everybody just from our local businesses, people not wearing masks to, you know, if you have a football game and you're playing a football game and all of a sudden one team, you know, has a COVID inflicted person, then it just spreads to the school that's doing everything right. So yeah, they've been working with those community health districts, but without universal mandate, it's just sort of a shot in the dark, I guess.
I know both of you have brought up the fear several times when speaking. Can you articulate a little bit that fear, both on the part of teachers and what you've heard from parents?
Yeah, and I guess I want to preface that with saying that myself and most teachers, teaching's in our blood. It's our passion. That's what we want to do. I want to get back to teach. My fear is that I may bring something home to a loved one. I know every year I'm going to spend a significant part of that year with various colds, viruses, and bugs. You know, usually throw in strep throat, maybe some bronchitis. I'm going to take one for the team every year, probably two or three. This year's a little bit different.
As a teacher, you're really aware of how quickly bugs can be passed around, right?
Absolutely. And I want to teach, but I want to do it in a safer way. And I felt pretty good about the measures that Des Moines Public put into place to allow me to teach, but to do that with in a little safer manner. Other teachers are scared. I'm hearing from teachers whose buildings are so overcrowded that even with some families choosing online, they're looking at teaching in a small 10 by 10 foot room with, you know, 15 students. I'm hearing about school districts requiring staff meetings with over 100 individuals prior to school starting. I'm hearing about from teachers who have spouses or a loved one in high-risk categories, and they've got to make a choice whether they can do their job, fulfill their passion for what they want to do, but then also having to consider whether that passion can cause the death of a loved one. For myself personally, I lost my mom when I was 12. I know what an untimely death can do to a family and the effect of one loss on so many lives. Teachers love to teach. We're healers. We're people that try and pass on our wisdom, but we don't want to do anything that's going to endanger the lives of anyone. That goes completely against the grain of what most of us feel in our heart.
Jeremy, you graphically articulated the fear in your obituary too, describing a terrible death. Is there anything else you can add in terms of just the fear and the concern?
Yeah. So last Wednesday, I woke up with a pretty bad headache, and I didn't have a fever, but I had it all pretty much. I had lots of the COVID symptoms. So I called my doctor, and the doctor suggested I get a COVID test, right? And I don't know how I would have been exposed to it, but I got a test for it. And for 4 days, I had to sit in my little room down here, and I just started thinking a lot about this is what it's going to be like at school. If you wake up and you have a little bit of a fever or a runny nose, every time I'm going to have to go get a COVID test, I'm going to have to be separated from my family. You know, and I started thinking about the morality of it. And every time this happens, I can't morally be around my family. I can't morally stop into to get coffee or through a drive-thru or whatever because I can't infect someone else. And the governor seems to want to think that it's okay for us, even if we're exposed, not showing symptoms, to be around kids. And I think that I think we have to ask ourselves, is that the moral question? I could not live with myself if, you know, I took something into school and I exposed, you know, 300 and some kids to it. It's really concerning to me. Even like Dan's is bringing you home to your family. I mean, I don't want to do that either, but I also don't want to spread it to the kids at school. And I think we're at a really crossroads here of what's acceptable, just to, learning when there is a solution to this. And that's, it's either online learning to keep people safe until it is safe, or do some kind of a hybrid thing where, it's necessary for kids to be safe and to have their parents be safe. And there's the whole economics, situation and problem with, you know, parents at work. But it's something we have to do and not just throw a bandaid on it and say, just go to school, everything's going to be okay. You know, cause we've been told for the last 4 months, stay home, wear a mask, stay away from everybody. And now it's okay. Go in a room with 32 kids and everything's fine. You know, you're essential workers, you know, and it's a problem. And that's why teachers are fearful, because, you know, there's just so many unknowns and they're just go for it. The mentality that they have, just go for it. It's scary.
So this is a week of action starting yesterday. Tell us a little bit first, how did this actually come together? Who planned the week of action? And this, the Coalition of Iowans for a Safer Return, is that kind of an umbrella name that was given for this week of action?
Correct. And Jeremy and I had been in contact. His group has been around a bit longer than ours is and is a bit bigger. After Drive for Lives had our event at the Capitol on the 24th, Jeremy reached out and asked if we could get together and talk about how we could coordinate a response to Governor Reynolds. I had also had some conversations with other education and community groups here in Des Moines. So Jeremy set up a Zoom meeting. We all got together and we started to talk about how we can affect some positive change and change the trajectory of guidelines coming out of the state. That was only about 2 weeks ago. Is that correct, Jeremy?
I think it's actually less than that, actually. Yeah. Came together really fast.
Okay. So you have something planned for every day of the week.
We do. Yesterday was Voice Your Story Day. We wanted teachers and allies to express why they were concerned and to share that. Today is support for school staff, support staff. We really want to recognize that schools are not just teachers. It takes a lot of moving parts and a lot of people to provide education to our communities, and we want to recognize all those folks. Tuesday, we're asking people to reach out and build awareness with others. We want people to have a conversation with somebody that might disagree with them, but to have that conversation in a respectful way, try and change some minds. Wednesday, we have a science theme day, and there will be a webinar that will have Dr. Megan Srinivas, who's an infectious disease physician in Fort Dodge, Helen Eddy, who's the director of Polk County Health, and Sarah Willett, who is a data scientist. That time will be released probably in the next couple days. On Thursday, we're going to have a press conference in solidarity with Marked by COVID. I'll let Jeremy talk about Marked by COVID. He's got a little more information about that national group. But we have a slate of speakers that will be holding a press conference at the Capitol. Jeremy, do you want to talk a little bit about Marked by COVID?
Marked by COVID was started by a woman named Kristen Urquiza from California, whose father, Mark, had died of COVID-19. Kristen has received some national publicity because her father died believing that it was okay to go out and it was safe. Her dad had no like underlying ailments that were known. But he believed the governor of Arizona, where he lived, and he believed the president, that everything was not real, that everything was safe. He went out, contracted the disease, and passed away from it. His birthday is August 13th. This is why they're holding it on Thursday. And to make this known that this is not a safe place for people to go out and to not take precautions. So Kristen's group is nationally organizing. She contacted us early on, and Dan and I decided that Thursday we would honor her and her father with our press conferences and days of action.
On that press conference, State Senator Claire Salcy, State Representative Ross Smith, myself, a representative from Public Health, and also Organized Labor will speak that day. Additionally, we will have a flash drive event similar to our event on the 24th that will take place in the area of Terrace Hill.
It's another car procession, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
In
Correct.
Des Moines.
Correct. On Friday, we're going to have a social media blitz. We just want people to really put out there the word as to why they're concerned and what changes we seek. And then on Saturday, there's a student center activity. There'll be more details coming out about that, but there are also groups of students who are becoming activists, obviously concerned about returning to school, as well as local flash drives that will be taking place regionally in different locations across Iowa.
For you who's listening to this, where can this person find out more about each event, each day? Where do they find all this?
There is a Facebook page that is public. You don't have to join a group, Iowans for a Safer Return to Learning. You can also find information on the ICANN site, the Iowa Citizen Action Network, where we have a sign-up form and also information on different events that we're holding.
Say that website again.
That is Iowa Citizen Action Network. If you Google Iowans for a Safer Return to Learning, the first two things that pop up are going to be an Action Network petition that has information about our efforts and that link to the Iowa Citizens Action Network site that has the sign up and information about events as well. The Facebook page also pops up on that Google search, and that's a great clearinghouse of information for different activities that we have planned.
Jeremy, did you get stories yesterday?
We did. I was actually just looking at them. There were stories from people who are concerned about bringing it home to their families. There was one person who's actually a conservative teacher who was very worried about it and who supports Governor Reynolds and some of the other things that she does, but thinks she's completely off base on this and would like her to change her mind. So it was really interesting to read some of those stories coming through yesterday.
And where can the stories be seen?
Actually, if you just type in the word, if you type in on Facebook hashtag at my story deserves a safe return, then all those stories will pop up, and even links to Dan's page and our page and his Drive for Lives page as well.
My story deserves a safe return.
Hashtag my story deserves a safe return. Yep.
Okay. Thank you. It's good to see that on Monday, actually, something's being acknowledged that's not talked about a lot, which is that there are so many other people involved than the teachers in terms of exposure in the schools and the support staff that goes along with a school. Well, we're running out of time. There's like a million more questions I have for you guys. But I'm just wondering if either of you have an analysis about why this is happening today in Iowa. Why do you think we're here right now?
I think there's a couple things. Number one, several years ago, oversight of the Department of Education was removed from the Board of Education and given to the governor, which, as a matter of practice, I think is a big issue because it allows for the politicization of educational policy. So there's that. Number two, there's been an assault on science in our country. Somehow facts and data and science has become debatable, questioned by our leaders. I think when you couple that education policy has become political with an acknowledgement that science is not accepted by a significant portion of our society, that leads to trouble.
Jeremy?
Yeah, I agree with Dan on that. I think if you ask anybody, Dan and I probably want to get, I'm bored out of my mind. I don't know about Dan, but I want to get back to normal. And I think that's a big part of it too, is just people want to get back to normal. And it's just, we're not ready to be back to normal. And and there's like a disconnect from reality on that. It's just, it's not going to be February of 2020. It's going to be a long stretch, and it's going to be a lot different, and people just have to wrap their minds around that. And you know, I blame a lot of this is President Trump's fault, really, like claiming this was a hoax earlier on, that this wasn't real. And I think that that mentality still holds. And that goes back to Dan with the science thing. It's just, you know, it can't be politicized. This is a virus. Viruses don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. It's just, it wants to kill and reproduce and move on. So, yeah, it just, people need to realize that this is real.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We've been hearing from Daniel Gutman, who is a teacher in Des Moines area, and Jeremy Drumkrieger, who's a teacher in the Sioux City area, and they're part of a coalition of organizations that are planning a week of action called Iowans for a Safer Return to Learning. And really kind of a main tenet of what your goals are for this is to rescind the return to school and to come up with a more nuanced way of returning to the school. Is that correct?
That would be part of our goal, as well as a mask mandate, expanding safety nets to vulnerable populations within the K-12 student and family community.
Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Rural Summer by Bananarama. Keith Morgan, Story County Emergency Coordinator, has joined us. Thank you for joining us, Keith. It's good to see you again. We've been speaking about concern of safety in schools. You've just received latest statistics on mass attacks.
Schools is what brought this to the forefront, but these attacks can happen anywhere. The report itself came out just about a year after the El Paso shooting, which was in a Walmart. And it killed 23 and injured another 23. And the main statistic from it was that there were 34 attacks in 2019 with 37 attackers, and 108 were killed and 178 were injured. That's the top line on it. But the report itself from the Secret Service that's produced annually went in and broke down some of the demographics on where these attacks occurred, what weapons were used, and what was the source or the spark for a lot of these. And I think it's important for us to revisit this issue and for us to think about, as organizations and as individuals, what we can do first off to try and prevent these kind of activities, and secondly, how to prepare ourselves to be ready to react should one of these unfortunate events occur.
Okay, great. And to you, the listener, I apologize. This is a very anxiety-ridden program today, but these are just apparently the times we're living in, so let's keep going here. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first off, to think about preventing this, one of the main things that came out about this is that two-thirds of these events had leading indicators that they were going to happen, and that leads to one of the main things that we talk about, not just for mass attacks, but for any crime or any event out there that is safety driven. If you see something, then it's important to bring it on up. And within an organization, it's important for there to be a structure to go ahead and receive concerns by employees, or if it's a church or something like that, that there's a structured way for that information to come on in, for it to be evaluated, and then for there to be action to be taken. And what some of the report was also talking about is that a lot of the triggers, the stressors, are out there right now. There's a lot of changes that are occurring within people's lives. There's financial stresses that are happening. People are losing jobs, and isolation can be a trigger for this. So this is one of those times for people to look around and to, if they notice that people that they're working with are under some of these stressors, and that they start to display those kind of activities that could indicate that there is a chance that they could switch over to violence, to go ahead and to talk to people about, you know, things like when they say, I'm going to come back and this place is going to pay for this. Don't take that lightly. Go ahead and report it on up. And as a part of that, you know, as more of the prevention on it, structurally, you've got to plan for one of these events within your organization, and again, you've got to prepare for them. So again, as the planning part, look around, find out first off, how can you receive this sort of stuff, information, how you're going to form a committee to look at it is usually the way it is, but still protecting the privacy of those individuals that are involved should it not be what it seems on the surface.
When you say form a committee, what are you suggesting that a committee do?
The committee would receive the information, try and evaluate it. If there is anybody within an organization, so for instance, within a business, you might have your HR people in there. You might have some senior leadership that's in there. If you have an individual that specializes in safety, bring those three people together to receive the information. The HR person
by the information
can help.
By the information, you mean if there's a feeling that somebody or something might happen, to kind of investigate. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. So if an employee were to come that says, person X over there has really been agitated, and he's been mentioning trying to make the company pay for it, or that person will pay for this, or again, just talking about violence and those sorts of things.
So Keith, I can imagine that if you, and a lot of organizations, including probably our own, if a committee was being asked to be put together like that, probably the first thing they would say was, we're not really equipped to evaluate something like this. Is there support or help, information for people that form these type of committees in terms of how they really should evaluate the situation?
The schools have done a lot of work on this. I have to say right now, I couldn't point you to a good source, and that's something that I'll get back to you on is how to form it. There is a lot of information out there on this stuff, and I'll research that. Some of the templates that I've heard of again are primarily a person that is knowledgeable in safety, so that they can see how that would impact any safety plans you have. Definitely your human resources people, because they're going to be aware of all of the legal aspects of this. And like I said, senior leadership, because they're the ones that are going to have to evaluate it and also consider some of the risk factors. They are the ones that ultimately will be responsible for the risk. So that's, in some respects, a general template for it. If a company has the employee programs where they could offer services to somebody that is having these kinds of stresses, they may also provide you some resources.
Okay, so what are ways that people, individuals and organizations or businesses can counteract the danger? You're saying this is possibly more of a danger right now than it normally is. What are things that people can do?
Again, it's the planning part of it. Look at how your business is formed. Can you control access so that you have a way of screening? Do you have a capability to communicate should one of these events occur within your building to inform people that there's an ongoing threat, where that threat is, how to avoid that threat, so that they can get clear of the threat? Educate your people. There is a lot of training that is available on different sites. The Department of Homeland Security has one that they call Run, Hide, Fight. It's a simple slogan to educate people on the three things that they should do should they encounter this. And the first thing we want people to do is just get out of the way of the threat. If you can exit the building, if you can get as far away from that threat as possible, we really encourage people. But that's where that communication comes in. You're notified of the threat, you exit the area. Should that not be possible, then there comes the hide, where you try and barricade yourself in and you try and separate yourself from the threat through, again, locking doors and hiding. If that's not possible, the last option we talk about is to fight, to not be somebody that just sits there, but to actively throw things at the individual as, again, you're trying to get out of the area or get to a different area where you might protect yourself. So those are the key ways that we talk about countering this. That's the one thing. And even if you're going out to a crowded place, always keep in mind, where are my exits? How do I observe what's going on so that I can see if there's a situation that's developing that's not safe?
Yeah, now actually here at KHOI, the Ames City Police made a visit here at our request and did a walkthrough with us on that topic, just if there was a problem, what would we do with our building? So it is something that is helpful.
And our law enforcement agencies across this county are willing to work with you on this. And as their time permits, they'll provide training, some of that run, hide, fight. They call it ALICE training in a different same thing, but by a different structure out there. So I do encourage everybody to contact, if they have any concerns or want more information, they can contact us here at Story County Emergency Management. Our phone number is 515-382-7315, and we'll try and assist you, hook you up with the right people to answer the specific questions you might have.
Fantastic. The Story County Emergency Management, 515-382-7315. Thank you, Keith. Any last words?
No, just again, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure on this one. Train your people. They'll thank you for it, because if you train them for within your organization, when they're out and about, if they should run into one of these situations, it'll help them there too.
Yeah, thank you. And just really, you know, a word of compassion and respect for everybody who's in a position of leadership and responsibility, anywhere from, you know, city officials down to parents, right?
Everybody is working hard to try and deal with a pretty complex situations.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's good to see you, Keith.
Good to talk.
Yeah. Anna, Anna Banana is here. You want to take us out of this difficult hour?
Yes, well, it certainly is intense. And so, but I'm not going to be able to provide any relief and intensity, because I would like to share a heart-to-heart message from Dr. Simone Key Soderberg, who teaches at Grandview. And this is what she read on air. I teach future teachers how to teach, and I wanted to share some words with them during these rather trying times for all. Do you all remember how at the beginning of the pandemic, everyone who would spring into action looking for ways to help one another, beer distilleries manufactured hand sanitizer, car companies worked on ventilator production, doctors and nurses put their lives and continue to put their lives on the line to help and protect others, and we all stayed home, some of us very isolated at times. But we knew that we were part of a special effort to flatten the curve and to protect the weak while we determined our next steps. All over social media, there were pleas to one another to stay home, wear a mask, socially distance, and do what you could as an American to help one another. Mr. Rogers said, when I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mom would say to me, look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping. For about 3 months, we all were, as Americans, the helpers. But then we got tired and our economy started to crash and the leadership was weak and fragmented and we all got scared. But we knew we needed to move forward somehow. When I begin a new class with a new group of future teachers, we always talk about why they want to be teachers, and invariably they express in some ways they want to help. They want to help a child, many children, to be the best that they can be, in spite of the often difficult circumstances that children face. Many times they share a story about how one of their teachers helped them, and that helped them allow to grow and thrive, and this inspires them to want to do the same thing. Teachers are helpers. And now teachers are facing so many unknowns. What we do know is that our often cramped classrooms, I had a classroom 1 year that was small and classes that were so large that some of them, many students sat on the floor to learn. And we know that in these cramped spaces that we will get physically sick at least once and sometimes more per year. We will get colds, maybe the flu, maybe a stomach bug, or maybe something else. We know that risk, and we understand the pay and the demanding schedule, and yet teachers get up every day to be helpers. When my future teachers, student teachers say they want to go into teaching to be helpers, I realize that presents a responsibility for me to also teach them self-care and to speak with them about compassion fatigue. But what should I tell them now? Should I tell them that their options for safety have run out because of politics? Should I tell them not to even consider making this sacrifice for their vocational calling until we have leadership with common sense? Should I lie to them and tell them that they will be safe? No. I will tell them to write letters, send emails, attend protests safely, and to keep demanding, as we have always demanded, the respect that the profession deserves. And I thank all the teachers and all those that keep us safe and healthy. Until next time, Anna Banana wishes you a day filled with inspiration and encouragement.
Thank you. Thank you, Anna Banana. And you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Chelly. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you again on the radio.